Hello, this is Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 6. Continuing on our series of the old way of seeing architecture and anything in general that has a historic perspective to it. So this is going to be Part 3. So we're going to headline this as 1830. The loss of the old way of seeing things. There is a line of demarcation, a time when the old way of seeing began to be lost. The turning point for architecture was the decade of the 1820s. After 1830, the former sure touch started to waver. Everyday architecture began to slip backward, and charm, pleasure in the thing itself, material, shape, shadow, were less often to be found in newly produced architecture. Buildings began to strike poses or else fall into the same routine. The poses could be very beautiful, and the routine, as in all endless repetition of factory bays, could have a power of its own, but the meaning of design had changed forever. Before 1830, pattern dominated design. After that time, use, including the creation of effect, took over. Pattern is an end in itself. The creation of effect, whether it is honesty, reality, or liveliness, has a motive to influence the observer. The style that announced the new priority was the Greek Revival around 1830. Giant columns began to show up on the fronts of houses. The pillars represented heroic democracy, a greatness of vision that many of the time felt was slipping away from America. The Greek Revival could be quite beautiful in its cool clarity of line and form. The shapes were grandly simple, and designers sometimes went to extremes to keep them so. Upstairs rooms were cast into shadow under the deep colonnades. Windows may be made of tiny or eliminated altogether in order not to disturb a cornice line. Jammed behind the unyielding simplicity of the facades were bedrooms and smoky kitchens or counting rooms and teller's wickets. The Grecian vogue came first to commercial buildings. Proportion was not abandoned. A high elegance of line was sought. Perfection back then. But the sheer size of the shapely forms could be quite disturbing. The temple, stuck onto the front of a little house or shop, was like an 18th century entry porch suddenly inflated, often to take up the whole facade itself. The style was elegant, austere, and quite dramatic. It did not abandon the ancient play of shapes. But it was the first style to make message more important. The Greek Revival swept across regions, traditions, and building types. It was the first national building style. Greek Revival homes were frequently called end houses because their gable ends often faced the street in the aggressive stance generally reserved for public and commercial buildings during the previous century. Modest Greek Revival buildings sometimes dispensed with columns altogether and made do with corner pilasters. Temple fronts, people also called the houses. However, the immediate model for the Greek Revival house was not a temple, but a bank. And where was that? That was in Philadelphia. The building that started that vogue was on 2nd Street in the United States in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. designed by William Strickland in 1818 and completed by 1824. Other architects, such as Benjamin Latrobe, had designed Greek Revival buildings as early as 1798. But it was Strickland's building that set off the explosion. The leading advocate of the style was not the architect, however, but his client, Nicholas Biddle. Biddle made Greek architecture a personal cause. The two great truths in the world are the Bible and Grecian architecture, he once wrote. He was the patron of other conspicuous Greek Revival buildings. In order to preserve the lines of the Temple of Learning, Biddle built for Girard College of Philadelphia in 1833. All the upper classrooms had to be lighted by skylights. Also in that year, Biddle encircled his wife's pre-existing mansion outside Philadelphia with white columns and crowned them, like his bank, with a Parthenon pediment. Thomas U. Walter, who later designed the U.S. Capitol Dome, was the architect for both the mansion and the college building. The white columns stood for purity, and they also stood for power. They announced that power could be pure, not corrupt. The Greek Revival opened the way to the multitude of styles that characterized the Victorian age. Each style was a way to produce a different group of effects. A building would try to invoke the meaning of domesticity or financial security or even religion. There are so many beautifully proportioned Victorian buildings that I do not and will not call them exceptions. But the trend away from harmony of line and shape began in Victorian times. Victorian was an era and an attitude rather than a particular style. The era was roughly 1830 until 1910. Victoria reigned from 1837 to 1901. The attitude was to put effect first. Beauty or ugliness was not the issue here. Posing was the point. After 1830, architecture became self-conscious. Two New England carpenters' handbooks, the first written in 1793 and the second in 1834, show how the vision of everyday design changes. In 1793, there is still mystery in the geometry of architecture. And this is a piece taken from Peter Nicholson in the Carpenter's New Guide. The uses of geometry are not confined to carpentry and architecture, but in the various branches of the mathematics, it opens and discovers to us their secrets. It teaches to us to contemplate truths, to trace the chain of them, subtle and almost imperceptible, as to frequently it is, and to follow them to the utmost extent. In 1834, the focus of design is no longer play, but professionalism. If the builder attempts to apply the rules of geometry to his art without the knowledge of theory, his efforts will prove abortive or should be well succeeded. Yet his work would be to avoid that of proportion and if incomplete. It is only by a competent knowledge of this science that the architect can accomplish his work in a simple and elegant style, or the artist so construct his lines as to be able to complete his design. And this, is, again, was taken from the builder's design. But in 1793, design is an adventure. Geometry discovers secrets, and it teaches us to trace the chain of truths. In 1834, it is only by a competent knowledge of this science that the architect can accomplish his work. Geometry is a set of rules that must be followed properly to produce a complete design. Correctness has superseded inspiration. The designer in 1834 is, above all, careful to avoid making mistakes. It is typical of that frame of mind that he feels a sense of time pressure, a concern lest the design not be completed. While the 1793 designer delights to follow the possibilities to the utmost extent. In comparison to today's design, though, the average buildings of 1830s are superb. What carpenter's handbook today talks about geometry at all? Harmony, or at least elegance, was then still admired, and geometry was still important. But the 1834 author had lost the former self-trust and the freedom it had given. The two handbooks suggest only a change in point of view, not a change in construction methods, or in the structure of the carpentry profession. Although some changes were definitely on the way. It was around 1834 that the balloon frame, or standardized lightweight components of construction, such as we call them today as 2x4s, was invented in Chicago. But there is not much chance Chester Hills had heard of the system at that time, because the balloon frame did not come east for another 20 years, and the new construction methods, when they did come, did not cause the change in point of view. But even today, carpentry is not far removed from that craft of 1793. Any builder who has access to the old way of seeing, can adventure amongst the truths of geometry as Peter Nicholson once did in the day. In 1829, Thomas Carlyle wrote, in Signs of the Times, "It is the age of machinery, in every outward and inward sense of the word. Wonder indeed is, on all hands, dying out. What cannot be investigated and understood mechanically cannot be investigated and understood at all." Carlyle was writing about England and Scotland, but what he said applied as well to all of America. Buildings became more literally and informationally than visual, and reading became the mental process to perceive them. 100 years after Carlyle, Lewis Mumford wrote, "What we cannot read, we cannot see." Many architects after 1830 carried on the old way of seeing beneath screens of practicality or sentiment or erudition or professionalism. The generation after 1830 wrote the first professional architects in America. Biddle's protege, Thomas Walter, was a founder of the American Institute of Architects. This new professionalism tended to separate visual thinking from daily life, but it also preserved the old way of seeing as a specialty. However, relatively few buildings, either before or after 1830, were designed by architects, and at our age, few stiller can be considered architecture, as Le Corbusier defined it. Today, most buildings are not patterns in light and shade, but images attached only to functions. Many observers were aware of what had been lost. Richard Upjohn, who designed New York's Trinity Church in 1839, wrote, "Might we not gain a valuable lesson while contemplating these works of our forefathers? Will we not see by comparing them with the works of our own hands that their authors regarded the law of harmony between a building and its surroundings better than what we do at this present time and day?" For the first time, architecture, or much of it, came to be despised. James Fenimore Cooper, in 1836, ridiculed the pomposity of the temple houses, the children trundling hoops before their doors, beef carried into their kitchens, and smoke issuing, moreover, from those unclassical objects, chimes bellied the formality of the style. The Greek Revival had largely run its course by 1850, but the change way of seeing remained. It didn't come back. On many houses, towers now took the place of the big porticos. There were Gothic towers, Italianate towers, Second Empire towers, Romanesque towers, Queen Anne towers. Mansard roofs were another way to make that grand gesture. When the effect was well done, as many times it was, the design yet may be harmonious, fascinating, and full of vigor. But pattern now was found under or around or behind symbol and story only. An old stereoception photo in Lowell, Massachusetts shows the Prescott Bank Building when it was new, around 1865. It is high Victorian, not quite halfway in time between the beginnings of the Greek Revival in the 1820s and the neo-colonials of the 1920s. On either side of the bank are shuttered houses, but only 20 years earlier, closer to the old way. The man lounging in the door in the photo is as tall as one of the windows of the neighboring older building. But the windows of the new building are much taller. The bank is more energetic than its neighbors of these old buildings. But something about its design is at once alarming and even funny. The roof is 17th century French, the way of Napoleon III. It is really a third-story wall tilted back to make a roof effect. The dormers are more or less medieval. The columns are an off-the-rack type of the Renaissance. The former easy discipline has cracked, but the building is not completely out of control. The cornice does hold to the line of its neighbor, but more important, there are strong regulating lines, one pattern at human scale and another, the dominant system at the giant vertical scale of the high windows. Why are those high windows? Why is the whole building a little frightening to me? It's because the designer has dug up so many different styles in one. Or does it have to do more with the proportions? Those windows squeezed and stretched out of relation to human size and shape. But many Victorian buildings are still very beautiful. On the main street of, say, Newburyport, Massachusetts, a house of about 1860 sits upon a little hilltop. It has big square bay windows, a flouncy cupola, festoons of white painted trim. It is also a composition of sure-handed integrity and richness. And it is a pleasure to look at as well. At the bottom of the same hill stands a big 17th century house. It rambles interestingly. There is some mystery in its shadows. But it is door, a very serious house. There is more of the age-old sparkle to its Victorian neighbor than it has itself. So as for the numerous ugly buildings of the Victorian day, they could have done far worse than to look awkward or scary or strange. 19th century buildings were still usually there. It might not be a there you would always want to be in, but it was a lot better than the nowhere the 20th century was to build in a few years to come. The Victorians did not want to produce hideous or fatuous or pompous buildings, any more than 20th century designers wanted to build deserts. The loss of harmony in architecture after 1830 was recognized immediately. but the idea that a particular state of consciousness was needed to design a harmonious building was not yet understood. When the paradigm for building shifted, there was no way to explain what had happened. Because the earlier teachings of harmonious design had centered upon the rules of geometry, not upon a way of seeing. It was thought that those rules were only applied to design, not they could come from the design process itself. In the years leading up to 1830, there were hints of what was to come, sudden jumps in the new way of thinking. For example, the griddling of Manhattan began around 1810, amidst strong objections, and as 1893 history describes, irate landlords assailed the surveyors with dogs, hot water, cabbages, and other distressful methods. I think we're going to stop here with part three of the old way of seeing architecture. So we're going to cut this off here. We have another windy day here and some wind chimes. So this is Greg Perry, and we're going to close out this episode. And don't forget to look us up on Instagram and at the Historic Preservationist, all one word, which leads us to IGTV for up to 15-minute videos. And please check out our YouTube channel, The Historic Preservationist, also. And hit that subscribe button because it really helps us out. It really helps me and inspires me to bring different historical content to our viewers and to our podcast here, to our listeners. So we just wanted to mention we have, I best believe, in the last year, about 31,000 listeners, active listeners all the time. So we're doing pretty well. So. And I want to know any comments of what anybody else wants in content coming up. So, Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist, signing out. Thanks, everyone, for listening.